Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution. Hello, and welcome to ID the Future. What's a rational response when you're confronted with nonsense of a high order? In this first part of a series of podcasts, Discovery Institute fellow Paul Nelson interviews Rabbi Moshe Averick, who explains the rational course for countering the new atheists.
I'm talking to Rabbi Moshe Averick, who is the author of Nonsense of a High Order, The Confused and Illusory World of the Atheist. This book just came out. It's a wonderful read, but I thought we could plunge in and ask Moshe a little bit more about the book in greater depth. But first, I'd like him to tell us a little something about himself.
Okay, first of all, Paul, it's a pleasure to be here with you. Very briefly, I essentially, in terms of my relationship to the book, I would say that I was ordained as an Orthodox rabbi in 1980. And essentially, since then, I've been teaching Jewish philosophy, theology, spirituality in a number of different places. I was in Canada, I was in Los Angeles, I was in Israel, I taught here in Chicago. The subject of belief in God, obviously, is something I've kind of been obsessed with for a while. So this is the end product of, I guess, that 30 years.
But you've written country western music.
And, yes, I have. I went through my wanna-be-a-rock-star stage. And believe it or not, and I wrote a series of kind of folky, country-ish, you know, Bob Dylan-ish type stuff. I got out of my system. Actually, I probably have about 30 or 40 hardcore fans who actually love the music. And occasionally somebody actually buys it on CDBaby.com. So.
And so we may put a cut in of one of those tunes at the end of this series, okay. Just for curious people. And you've also got kids and grandkids.
Yes, I have 8 children.
Oh my goodness.
And thank God, beautiful kids. And I have 7 grandchildren. And that number's growing all the time.
So. Wonderful. Well, in the book, you talk about coming back to the U.S. from Israel.
Right.
And walking into a bookstore. Lay out that scene, because it's a very kind of arresting opening for the whole story you're going to tell in the book.
Right. I had been living in Israel for 14 years. That was from like 1993 to 2007. I got to Israel in 1993 just as with the Oslo Accords, as so peace broke out in the Middle East, and it's been very peaceful ever since. But in any case, so I was living in a very religious neighborhood. I didn't have a television. I, you know, because of all the crazy things going on around us, there really was no need for entertainment. And I'm being very serious. It was entertaining enough just being in Israel and Jerusalem at the time. Essentially, you know, to skip those 14 years, I came back to the States. I came back to live in Chicago, and I took a long walk, and I see this thing, Borders Bookstore. Ooh, never heard of that before. I walked into the bookstore, and everywhere was, I see the face of Richard Dawkins, of Christopher Hitchens. I saw Sam Harris. Like, all over the store were these books by these famous, obviously, atheist authors. Now, that really got me excited, because I vaguely heard about some of these people in Israel. And because this whole subject is like an obsession with me, I basically stayed there the whole afternoon, and I started reading these books.
And you were disappointed. What disappointed
right.
you?
Well, what disappointed me is I was hoping that, you know, maybe there was a sort of these books were inspired by some creative burst of energy of a seeking of, you know, for reality, for truth, and this was sort of their expression of it. You know, and I have no problem talking to somebody who is a skeptic or a doubter, or a non-believer, an atheist, and, you know, and sometimes they're very honest and they've got some very good questions. In these books, I didn't find that. I found basically, for the most part, it was a raving and ranting about all the horrible things religious people did, and the actual intellectual arguments they put forth, I thought, were so weak and so where they were existed at all. I almost thought it was just non-existent. It was a lot of I felt it was like most of them were just one long raving and ranting. That's all.
So that kind of gave you your motivation,
right? I felt, you know, someone, you know, I have to respond to this. This is, you know, I was a little outraged, actually, that these people were getting away with this stuff. So
now on the other end of that, we've got the book. And
right.
It's interesting to me, though, that the story could have gone very differently. You might have found books there that deeply challenged your own theism. that gave arguments that you hadn't seen before that weren't ranting and raving.
Right.
But instead, you were offended by the poor quality of the reasoning, and you said, well, I've got to write something to respond to this.
Right.
And that gave you your motivation. Now, early in the book, you talk about something you call the atheistic disconnect. Can you spell that out a little bit?
What I noticed is that, you know, I have certainly spoken to atheists or skeptics who are very aware of the implications of their atheistic beliefs. They're honest about it. They understand the problems. They understand some of the problematic implications, like, say, particularly in the area of, like, you know, morality or meaning and purpose in life. And they're upfront and they're honest. They say, yes, you know, there's problems here. I felt that the guys and the people who wrote these books, like Dawkins, Hitchens, Harris, most of them, and I found that many of so-called wannabe amateur atheists now who've been inspired by these guys, most of them have almost no idea of what, or they almost pretend as if the implications of atheism don't exist, and they take these giant leaps where they, well, you know, where they just simply avoid, I guess what you could say, the, you know, the real pitfalls in having an atheistic worldview. One of the examples that I used in the first chapter, kind of the introductory chapter, was, you know, Christopher Hitchens will talk, makes a speech about, he finds that it's very inspiring that all men are related to groundworms. Why? Because we're all, makes us all brothers. And if we're all brothers, that means that, you know, racism is ridiculous. He says this. He comes out so strongly how horrible racism, it's an artificial construct. We're all men are related. Well, that's great. You know, all men are related. Like, we are as valueless as groundworms. Like, so why would you, that inspire you? In other words, it's not that all men are brothers that were so valuable and noble and transcendent. We are glorified cockroaches. Like, why does that make racism silly? In other words, it makes all of life silly is what it does. Forget about racism. But it's like he pretends it doesn't exist. He pretends that's not a question.
Rather than the unity of humanity with the rest of life, elevating humanity.
Right.
It, in fact, takes us the other direction.
Yeah, exactly. It makes us the level of bacteria. I mean, why would you... Why, and he says this in a speech where he's trying to inspire these college kids and how noble atheism... If Jean-Paul Sartre can say straight out, you know, I'm in complete despondency because God doesn't exist, at least that's honest. You know, he may not have gone in the right direction, but that's an honest statement. Where's Hitchens make an honest statement like that?
Yeah, it's there's a kind of strange tunnel vision, I guess you could say, in much of the writing of the new atheists. They tend to be cheerful, optimistic, good manners. They would never do some of the horrendous things that Joseph Stalin did, and so forth. They disavow him. They disavow the abuses, let's say, even of the French Revolution, where people were being separated from their heads at great dispatch under the aegis of brotherhood and reason. But of course, a really thoroughgoing materialism or atheism is a terrible thing to look straight in the face. A terrible thing, frightening thing to look straight in the face. I've often said to audiences that the last person you would ever want to live next door to is a thoroughly consistent materialist.
Right, exactly.
Explain a bit upon that, because in our early conversations last year as you were working on the book, we talked a bit about this skewed, or I can't quite find the right words, this kind of tunnel vision of the so-called new atheist, that give atheism its place, the world will be a wonderful place to live.
Well, for instance, let's continue with Christopher Hitchens. In the same speech, this particular speech he made at Sewanee University, which was called "The Moral Necessity of Atheism," you know, which in itself is kind of a strange title. He talks about how much he admires American democracy. Now, you know, one would think, no matter how you're going to explain, I've heard people argue back and forth, I have no expertise in this, about the exact, you know, nature of the religious outlook of, say, Thomas Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin, all these guys, whether they were, you know, Southern Baptists, or whether they were, you know, Lutherans, or whether they were sort of, you know, Unitarian, whatever it was. One thing is clear, they believed in that man had a higher source. You know, the Declaration of Independence says all men are created equal, they've been endowed by their creator with unalienable rights. This is an inspiring idea. That's the basis for democracy. So how does Christopher Hitchens deal with that and call his book "Religion Poisons Everything"? He has a very simple solution. He says, the United States. He says, I'm writing this book in the introduction to his book called The Portable Atheist, which is a collection of atheistic essays. He says, I'm writing this book on July 4th, whatever year it was, 2006, 2007, the anniversary of the first secular republic. He says, how does he solve the problem? Simple. He says, it has nothing to do. It's totally secular. So what about the section where it says we've been created by God? What about the section where Thomas Paine talks about we're all men are created by God? It doesn't matter. We're secular. No, he didn't really mean that. He was a deist. He was a neist. He was a but. You know, it's like a janky man. He didn't really believe in God. He said it was God. It was really God. It was this. It was that. You know, he just, it's like it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. What difference does it make? So this is the type of why I called the book Nonsense of a High Order. I saw this, by the way, the phrase Nonsense of a High Order is something that Sir Fred Hoyle wrote, I think later in his career. He started investigating origin of life, and he makes a statement to the effect that the idea that the thousands of enzymes and the operating cell of a living organism could evolve, could come out of a prebiotic swamp, he says it's nonsense of a high order. So as soon as I saw that phrase, I said, that's the name of the book, right there. So.
That's wonderful. In chapter two, to provide a basis for the discussion, you lay out what you call the ground rules. Say a little bit about those.
The ground rules are basically sort of the conceptual and philosophical paradigms of the discussion. I have found that many times what gets in the way of a person approaching the belief in God rationally is certain misconceptions in approaching the problem, not about the issue itself, but in the way they approach the problem. I'll give you one example. So what I try to do is deal with that in this chapter, and then we go into the actual discussion. Example. You have a guy by the name of Mark Isaac, wrote a book called The Counter-Creationism Handbook. And in it, when he gets to the section on origin of life, he says, everybody agrees that origin of life is a very difficult problem. However, just because it's difficult does not mean that it's impossible. Now, if I would say to a skeptic, let's say we were discussing the historicity of the flood, was there a flood? And I would say to him, and he would say, well, what's the evidence there was a flood? I would say, look, I don't have any evidence, but it doesn't mean it's impossible. Now, he would laugh at me. He said, what kind of ridiculous statement is it? And it would be a ridiculous thing to say. Either I'd say to him, here's my evidence, or I'd say, you know what? I don't have any evidence. I don't know what to tell you. If I was being, you know, if that was the truth. It's not the truth, by the way. But it happens to be that the flood is one of the most widely recorded historical events, but that's besides the point. But he says this without blinking an eye, as if this is a meaningful argument. And then he goes on to say, he lists six of the major speculative theories about origin of life. And then as number seven, and I wrote in the book, I said, I'm not kidding, and I'm saying to you, Paul, I'm not kidding. He actually wrote as possibility number seven for the origin of life, something that no one has thought of yet. Now, I don't think Mark Isaac is stupid. How do you write something that no one has thought? If a skeptic would say to me, Rabbi, how do you know that God spoke at Mount Sinai? Give me the reasons why you believe that. Something that no one has thought of yet. Now, you'd think I'm a complete idiot. But he writes this in a book as if this is an intelligent presentation. But the problem, Paul, is not just Mark Isaac writes it. If you look at Francis Crick in his book Life Itself, he has a very famous, often quoted statement that life seems to be a miracle. So many are the conditions that would have to come about. And then he goes on, but it doesn't mean it couldn't have started naturally. It looks like a miracle, but it could have happened. Like Jackie Mason, could have happened, might have happened, could have happened, maybe it did. You know, is it a miraculous means? When he says it seems to be a miracle, it means I can't conceive of how it could have happened, but maybe it did. Well, that's fine, maybe it did, but that's certainly not a scientific statement. It's not a reasonable statement.
What kind of a commitment would you say that represents? It's not a commitment to evidence because the evidence is not available.
Yeah, it is a commitment as an article of faith. They have, this is, and particularly, this is what I have a whole chapter in the book in Origin of Life. They have made a priori commitment, an article of faith. There is life started naturalistically. We just have to find out how. We will not consider anything else. Anything else is crazy, medieval, wacko, fundamentalist nonsense. We will not even consider that.
So in effect, at that point, the atheist is staking a metaphysical claim.
Right.
On the future success of science, let's say,
right,
in the face of an absence of evidence,
exactly. You know, and now, if somebody said, and I write this in the book, if Robert Shapiro had said, "I don't know how life started. It's a big problem," and but I'm not prepared to accept an intelligent creator until I feel I've exhausted all the naturalistic possibilities. Fine, honest statement. Good, we can talk. But that's not what he said. For instance, one of the reasons you're talking is because of this thing that Jerry Coyne put on his blog in response to this article about my book in the Huffington Post. So Jerry Coyne writes, well, sure, we don't know how life started, but I'm sure by 50 years from now, we will have an answer. So, like, he wants me to wait around 50 years. Like, am I, like, 50 years, again, and I say back, Dr. Coyne, if I was trying to convince you of the truth of the revelation of Mount Sinai, and you said, well, where's your evidence? I would say, look, I don't have any evidence, but by 50 years from now, I'm sure we'll have it all figured out. I mean, whatever, he would laugh at me, and I laugh at him. And this is and the problem is, they don't even realize they're saying these things. They think they're being perfectly rational. If I would be nasty about it, I'd say either they've been brainwashed, they have entered into the realm of a fanatical belief. I've accepted this with no evidence. It's a leap of faith. But that's what's happening. And I should give example after example in the book.
Want to spend your summer studying intelligent design in Seattle for free? Discovery Institute is raising up the next generation of scientists and scholars with the 2011 Summer Seminars for college juniors, seniors, and graduate students. The two intensive 9-day learning opportunities run from July 8th through 16th. This year, in addition to the seminar focusing on ID and the natural sciences, the Center for Science and Culture announces the new C.S. Lewis Fellows Program on Science and Society, which will explore the growing impact of science on politics, economics, social policy, bioethics, theology, and the arts. Discovery Institute will pay expenses for students who are accepted into the programs, and applications are open now through April 22nd, 2011. For more information, visit www.discovery.org/STEM. That's www.discovery.org/SEM. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.